This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The Gonsalves family is filing a lawsuit against WSU. That's the university that Brian Koberger was a teaching assistant at, not the school at which their children were attending or their daughter was attending, but certainly part of the ecosystem of the story of Brian Koberger. Today we're going to be tackling the thing everyone tiptoes around, the difference between a person who's simply socially odd and a person who is showing red flags that point towards potential danger. Washington State University had dozens of complaints against Brian Koberger, women who felt physically uncomfortable, faculty who documented behavioral issues, a department that held mandatory meetings because of one student, one teaching assistant, and at the same time, a man with no criminal history, no documented violence, no official reason to remove him really from anything. This is where psychology, pattern recognition, civil liberties, and institutional failure all collide. And nobody breaks down that collision like Robin Drake, who's going to help us get into this conversation and help dissect what exactly it is we're looking at when we hear about the Gonsalves' decision to sue the school. They're not saying that the school would have prevented the murders. What they're saying is, they have an obligation when you have enough complaints to do something a little more proactively than they did, because they did eventually fire him. But it did take a lot of checking boxes and a lot of meetings and a lot of this and a lot of that before anything actually took place. Robin, when you look at the specific behaviors reported, the intense staring, blocking doorways, hovering near women's offices, what do those behaviors indicate from a human behavior standpoint, not criminally, just instinctual human signaling?
Yeah, so those behaviors that Koberger was exhibiting are behaviors of control. Control and inappropriate, healthy behavior, unhealthy behavior, I should say, just because he was off socially, just way, way off. And like you said, just because you're socially off doesn't mean that you're doing any criminal activity. But when you look at, as we do, our arcs and norms of human behavior in context in certain areas, he was definitely standing out from that. And part of that is he would then fall into, especially as an employee, a standard of conduct that is incongruent with his condition of employment, because every employment organization has, you know, a clause in there that says professional conduct. Mm-hmm. And clearly his behavior was unprofessional, but what they lacked was leadership. And it doesn't surprise me at all that the family that exudes leadership, mm-hmm, is suing the university that failed completely at leadership, because that's what this was. The more and more I dug at this and said what was missing, because it's hard to kind of put your hands or fingers on it. It really just came striking out at me, when that was leadership. There was kind of a policy, but when you fear enacting a policy, it means that people are fearful of what will happen to them. So they're, mm-hmm, not going to take action. And so what empowers people to not be fearful? Strong leadership that backs a policy, and that's what they lacked.
So do you think they could have done, if they had gotten in Brian's face, and not aggressively, but look, we've got complaints against you, we're concerned about, well, right, but spoke to him and said, we are not going to tolerate this. Does that change how a perpetrator performs in that environment? Do they become more aggressive? Do they go, wow, okay, I'm being disciplined, I need to do something? What happens with somebody like this? Not necessarily in Brian's case, but when you see someone like this, what do you do?
Yeah, it's a really sticky one, Stacey, because, yeah, I mean, someone like Koberger, where, again, I think he was on an arc of predestiny of doing violence against, yeah, human beings, because he had a lot of issues that were unable to be mitigated. Because I really think his family did a good job of trying to mitigate it. Could they have done better? Hindsight's always 20/20. Anyone can always do better. But what happened in this case was that if you're going to intercede, and they needed to intercede earlier, and it's one of the hardest lessons I learned in the Marine Corps as a young Marine Corps officer, was that, hey, if I had a behavior of one of my Marines that was off, I had, and I had, when I was at Parris Island, I had drill instructors that were four times much experienced, twice as old as me, that I was leading. if they did a behavior that was completely inappropriate and off, that was against policy and procedure, I had to sit them down in front of me. I had to write it out exactly what the expectations were for the behavior, what the standard was, how their exact observed behavior was incongruent with that. I sign it, you sign it, and then we'll have another discussion if this doesn't change in a certain time frame. And then you have it documented, and then you can dismiss someone. Now, to the greater question, would that have prevented anything? Those hypotheticals are so hard because he was on an arc. But what I saw from what the Gonzalez's were trying to do, and rightfully so, they're not saying that this would have prevented the deaths of our daughter or the other three children, but it might have mitigated it, might have done something. But at the very least, there should be some sort of culpability for a lack of leadership, a lack of enforcing policies. Because when I did deep research on this, I said, all right, so does WSU have a policy of this kind of conduct? And yes, they do. And I said, who's responsible for that policy? It can't be locked down. I said, who came up with that policy? It can't be locked down. It's like the HR mm-hmm. office. I said, who is ultimately responsible for that policy? In other words, who does it get reported to? And it's nebulous. And when things are nebulous, there's fear. No fear, people take action until it's shoved down on you because people are so afraid of being labeled. All these different labels today, like any form of profiling whatsoever, and we'll get fearful. Now, there are universities, I did the research on this, there are universities that actually have a centralized point where you can report things without fear for not being profiling or anything like that. Like UConn has it, University of Wisconsin has it, because I was trying to do we have a compare and contrast where there's universities doing it properly? Yes, there are. It's just in this case, they had a policy-ish, but zero knowledge of who's responsible for report this to besides department heads, which then are going to have to pass it up. In other words, there was no centralized point of leadership that said, hey, I am on this. I got your back. We got to intervene earlier. And here's how to do it. Like literally just what I said, it is so easy to not label someone as good, bad, right, or wrong. Here's just behavior that's incongruent, like blocking doors. Right. Like hovering over people, like staring at people. These are actually observed behaviors. You put it down on a piece of paper. This is what we're defining as unprofessional for a teaching assistant. Don't do this again. Don't ever get in the way of someone again. Don't do this behavior again. I sign, you sign. Because now it's not me saying, I heard this or I think you shouldn't be doing this. No, here's the behavior. Don't do it. Sign, you sign. If I see it again in a week, you're gone. If they'd done that earlier on, things would have.
And it seems like they did do that to a certain extent. It's just more so about how effective was it? And obviously, some people you can write them up all you want. If this is how they act, it's how they act, and you're not going to change it if they don't think anything's wrong. But it's at what point how many warnings do you give? Eventually, they did fire him, but it took many, many months to get there and many, many complaints to get there. And that's where it's the weird ground. It's that middle, it's that gray area where you have the university or you have whatever entity you want to talk about, whether it's this case or another case, where people are so fearful that they're going to step on the rights of basically the perpetrator or someone who's causing the uncomfortable behavior, if it's standing in the doorway or whatever it may be. They're fearful that they're going to offend that person, that person is going to have some sort of rights that trump the rights of the person being felt uncomfortable, because you get into the territory of, well, are they autistic? Is this some sort of autism thing? Or there's always the what ifs. And there's too many what ifs where people just don't seem to be able to come out and feel legally or professionally safe to call out this type of behavior in any sort of real, effective, true, authentic way. And then you have the people who are portraying this behavior that either are completely clueless about it, which I think Koberger was, or they are doing it intentionally and they know exactly what they're doing and they're not going to stop. But it's how do you How do you correct this? How do you get in there? How is WSU wrong in what they did here? They did document. They did have talks. They did sit down. They did warn. It didn't happen like that overnight, but they did follow up on all these things. And after so many strikes, they did finally get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And at about the pace I would expect a university to do it at, too. And maybe that's the weird part here is we all expect this to take forever because that's how it seems to go because of so many precautions. I think WSU sits in a really weird place where damned if you do, damned if you don't. Mm-hmm. They can't just fire the guy for being weird and awkward and creepy. That's not breaking any laws, and they can't kick him out either for that. They're going to get sued by him or whoever they would be doing that to. At the same point, you're putting all these people in possible harm's way, but it's just possible. We don't know because there hasn't been any sort of actual harm done other than them feeling uncomfortable by the actions of Koberger in this case. I don't know where to sit on this. I mean, I wish we could do something more proactive, but I feel legally, I think their hands are tied.
So I think it's a frustration because I don't think people have thought through this innovatively. And here's okay. what I mean. Here's an idea of what I think could be done. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm with you. And that's why I think it's going to be a tough lawsuit for the Gonclaves to pursue just because of all these things you're talking about. They didn't fail in the ultimate execution. Where I believe they could do better is the tempo. And when you actually, and here's a way you can escalate that tempo, because tempo is slowed when people have fear. And the way you get over fear, again, let's go back to the leadership model. And here's what you can do, because this, I'm going to walk through what we did on the espionage side of things. Because when you're going to do a major case where you're going to try to, entrap a spy, but when you're trying to do a double agent operation and you're trying to pass information, fake information to a bad guy on the other side of the steel curtain or whatever on the Russian side or something, you have to get pre-approvals for things. Mm-hmm. And you're always constantly going through what ifs, what ifs, what ifs, what ifs, what ifs. We go through legal counsel, we go through the CIA, we go through State Department, we game plan out all the what ifs so that when we actually go to execute, we can execute this fast. Because if you slow tempo, the bad guy thinks they have freedom to do whatever they want. So I know it's kind of nebulous what I was talking about. So here's what we do on this side. Here's where people do much better with tempo. And also, when tempo is in place, it's actually a great mitigator of abhorrent actions, because when a potential perpetrator knows that there's clear reciprocity for an action they're taking, they're less likely to take that action. Because if they can live in the gray zone, they're going to live in the gray zone as long as they possibly can. When things aren't clear, when they're not defined, when they don't think there is courage by people to take action. Because how they do it, they poke a little bit. Let's see if there's a reaction. Let's poke a little bit more, see if a reaction. And if there's slow to reaction, they're going to keep poking and trying to encircle their realm of control because they're slow to react, because there's soft words being used against them. Because remember, we're dealing with a highly developed predator that doesn't use soft words, that doesn't think softly. And when you're being treated that way with kid gloves because you're afraid of this, and this. So how mm-hmm. do we empower people to not be fearful? All these things we're talking about here is what you play out before it happens. Everything, all these ahas and what ups and what things we should have done are reactionary. No one there thought enough proactively to what do we have to make sure we can do like this if this situation happens. So there's tons of case studies like Koberger out there. What you do is this. If you're in the leadership of this university, of HR, is you say, all right, here's our policy. Now we got to play to what ifs. How do we enact this policy, empower people to feel safe to report, empower people to feel safe to do X, Y, and Z, and how do we do it so that we feel safe to support them? Well, we got to get the lawyers involved. How do we do this so it doesn't make us liable? So we need to paper it this way. We need to paper it this way. So you do training, you use sensitivity training, and you actually empower people to know here's the process, here's procedure, here's the measure, here's the legal side. So that way, any of these nefarious people that think, oh, they'll never do it because the law's on my side. No, we let them know right up front. We talk to our lawyers. Lawyers say this. This is how we're going to do things. So again, and what's this all doing? We're treating people with respect. We're being ultimately transparent. And for what? Safety. Safety can't take a backseat ever. And if we got to do these things and don't go through these machinations ahead of time to give our lawyers the what ifs, it's something like a Koberger case, but it's unsafe. What can we do? What legally can we do? What legally can it do? So that way the people are actually on the ground at the granular level, feel empowered to do something so it doesn't drag on and drag on. And so that the person, the perpetrator of evil, doesn't feel they can live in a gray zone for as long as they do.
I mean, in this case, I mean, I hear you. It's and that's where I think a lot of it just backs up to is the legal end of things of, well, you can't do this
because of this, because of that,
right? Because everybody has too many rights, essentially is what it comes down to. When everybody has too many rights, nobody's actually being protected because everybody has the right to do everything to everybody. And then what do we have? But with this, how, I mean, in this case specifically, let's say Koberger never went through and actually killed the people, was just autistic and creepy in his mannerisms, completely clueless about them, because I think he is clueless about them. I don't think he has any idea just how creepy his behavior is and how bizarre it is. And I think it's just his modality. It's how he works. It's how his brain functions. His brain tells him, this is what you do. This is how you do it. And then the rest of the world, it's like, Jesus, why are you acting like that? And he's just as confused, like, why are people reacting to me this way? He's off. I mean, it's part of the autism, and the way that he's seeing things and the way he's interpreting things is very different than the way other people would do it. So how do you get in there in a case like this and try to correct behavior that really can't be that corrected because it's just part of who he is? If you're autistic, you can't be like, oh, let me be less autistic for you today. It's just how the brain works. It's how they're going to function. Can there be learned behavior of, well, I'm going to walk this back. I'm going to learn not to do it. Emulating behavior. Yes, that certainly is a thing to a certain extent. Again, depending on where you are on this spectrum and what you're going to understand and what you're going to pick up and what you're going to accept. I just don't know. And look, I'm not trying to defend Koberger here, and I'm not trying to defend WSU, but I just don't know when you have somebody that has a brain that works as differently as Koberger's did, that you can get out in front of this and foolproof predict or stop or really do much of anything. And what do you do at the end of the day here? Let's say they did act a little faster. So they fired him. If they would have fired him 2 months sooner, right, would that have stopped anything? Maybe he would have moved back home. Maybe. Yep. But at the same point, you're passing the trash then, which is the problem that we have in a lot of education systems, a lot of public education systems, elementary education and high school education and things of that nature. That's what we were talking about earlier this year with the Devil's Den case and how he got passed from school to school to school. Yeah. And like, how did nobody say anything? How did nobody do anything? Well, they did kind of, but it all ended up being locked down into the confines of each school, and nobody could share their stories with anybody. Again, all because of rights, because of the legal issues, not because people didn't want to do what was right, what was morally right, what would actually be ethical and for the safety of others, but because, again, laws and fear of being sued. It's a lot of people operating with a lot of fear in every which turn they come at in situations like this, it feels like.
Yeah, these are tough ones for us as a society, but I'm going to give probably a controversial Gen X answer on this one. You know, some people just aren't suited for certain jobs.
Yeah.
You know,
100%.
So if he can't overcome his autism and how he's communicating, okay, we can work on it. We can try transparency. We can let your student body know, hey, he's working on these things. And if everyone agrees, hey, let's give him a shot. Great. But otherwise, then you shouldn't be fucking teaching. You know, get another job. Yeah. So, I mean, I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a Navy pilot. I want to do all these things in life. I mean, people ask me all the time, Robin, how'd you get to be the chief behavioral analysis program in the FBI? It was easy. I failed at everything else I wanted to do because I was incongruent with with what I want to do. I didn't have the intellect to get through aerospace engineering. So you know what? I couldn't be an aerospace engineer. You know what Robin did? He figured out something else. And so just because he thinks he's entitled to do this because he had Professor Ramsland saying he's good at criminology, you know what? But maybe you really shouldn't teach because you're kind of a creepo. And if the bottom line, the university doesn't exist to give him a job. The university exists to educate their kids in a safe environment so they can learn. And if the guy you have teaching them is incongruent and incompatible and no one's learning because he's such a friggin' creep, then you got to get rid of him. It's incongruent. Go find another job. Not saying that you're dysfunctional in life, but you know what? Your lack of ability to communicate and not come across creepy. And if you, again, if you're not overcoming it, you put them on a PIP or whatever you're doing. If it ain't working, you just aren't meant to do this. There's a lot of people in life. You're just not meant to do things. That's why you get fired. That's why you move on. That's why you try other things. And that's how we learn and get better, because we get a good life rep in. Because he, I mean, just think about what he could learn. All right. Instead of being coddled and told you're great at doing this and eventually, can you imagine if he had actually passed and became a professor? Who the hell would take his course?
Right.
It's ridiculous because he's so creepy. He's horrible. He's misogynistic. All the things he's accused of. So the thing he was actually pursuing in life was completely incongruent with him being successful at it. So find something else with that skill set.
Are there places, and I first let me preface it, I am not defending Brian Koberger, but is there a place for him to get the help that he needs to do the job that he wants and have, I don't know, somebody to babysit him? And it's not the university's job, but are there places in our world for someone like him who has something going on so that he can do a job, use his skills, and maybe learn something instead of just being thrown to the wolves?
So I think so, yes. I don't know those places, but I know some good friends that became good friends and associates and contacts of mine that have, that are way high on the spectrum, that actually are barred lawyers. They're very good at certain things because they actually have the one thing that Koberger completely lacks. And so people can overcome an awful lot when you have what? Humility.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I suck at this. I'm going to get in reps over here. So my entire life, oh boy, I'm using a me statement. I hate these things in here because, again, I'm hypersensitive to it. But all my active empathy, curiosity, understanding, deep love of others, and being so deeply curious when I see things and people incongruent with things that I normally accept in life, that wasn't me 50 years ago. You know, I grew up a snarky, self-centered, not self-centered really, but, you know, snarky extrovert, you know, in upstate New York that, you know, I had a mouth that ran away with me. And in order to overcome those things, you get a lot of reps and humbling moments. But I had only one thing that was going right in my mindset, and that was I owned it. When something went sideways, I said, oh, I must be doing something wrong. And see, that's what Koberger has got wrong. That's what all these broken people we talk about on the show have wrong, is they have so little emotional intelligence. Their EQ is so bottomed out. I don't care about your IQ. It's no measure of life success at all. Their EQ is so bottomed out, their self-awareness is so low that they have a lack of ability to improve in these areas. Their arc, their baseline is flat. And so people can learn. They can get better. If you're on the spectrum, can you do jobs? And Stacey, when you said it, it's like, no one's entitled to a job. No one owes you a job. You either can get better and you do the job or not. And he clearly couldn't, because his effect, his baseline understanding of who he was zero. Hey, go get some reps, go get some humility, and then you can try again. But now you're completely incompatible with this job. You know, my son, you know, the fighter jet pilot guy, and my daughter too, you know, the amazing labor and delivery nurse. Every day I tell my son as he's going out to fly this jet, I said the three things. As he's getting a bad day coming up or a challenging day, I always remember him these things. I say, stay positive, stay safe, and be a great student. That's our mantra in life. You do those three things and everything else will flow. But that's exactly what he missed. Koberger was not positive. He's always a wound collector. Definitely not a good student. And safety, he make people feel unsafe. And so he was bottomed out on those three major pillars that actually allow us to move forward in life and get some great healthy reps in.
We're digging into the case against Brian, not just against Brian Koberger, but now a new case that has erupted out of this. And this is a case of the Gonzalez family going against WSU, where Brian Koberger was the teaching assistant. They are arguing and they are saying, hey, you know what? There was a lot of warning signs here. Why didn't you act sooner? Why was this guy allowed to basically fester and hang out as long as he did before they finally called it quits with him? Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, with us as we are breaking it down. Let's talk about the escalation a bit. I mean, WSU did have meetings. They had documentation. They had warnings. So they ultimately did fire him as a TA. But some of those documentation, some of those complaints, do we need a system that doesn't that handles certain complaints with more seriousness and with a different, I don't know, different perspective, a different level of observation than others? Because it seems some of these, especially when you see a pattern of them, of the misogynistic behavior, of the disrespect towards women, of the harsher grading towards women. I mean, these, number one, if you get just one kind of standalone, this is weird. Okay, well, let's see if this is a pattern. Clearly, mm-hmm. It became a pattern very quickly. When they start identifying patterns like that, when an institution starts seeing patterns like this of behavior in someone that we know is just broken behavior, it's not going to be changed. This is pathological type behavior. If this is in your mind, if you're going to act like this towards women, there's no meeting, there's no video you're going to watch, there's no training right. You're going to get that's going to make you a different human being. But yet we seem to think that, well, if we follow these paths, legally binding paths that say we did this, then we're covered at least, and hopefully they're going to somehow magically change. There seems to be a level of magical thinking with some HR departments and the legal community in how we handle people like this, where we give them too many passes and too many chances. And a lot of it, it's fear-based. It's to cover institutions' butt from a lawsuit of them suing for being fired prematurely or for not good enough cause. But do we need something more? And maybe it is something that needs to be litigated where, look, if you're crossing these lines over here, it's just you're done. You're out. You've shown a pattern here. We don't need to see what the aftermath is going to be because we know where this is all going to end at some point in time. Should there just be more of a zero tolerance type policy to this sort of behavior and less chances given over and over and over to anyone, autistic or not? Either you're going to follow these things or you're not. Because at the end of the day, you're making all these people uncomfortable. You're making them feel unsafe. And sorry, once you got a pattern and you're proving it, we just don't have time for you anymore.
Yeah, I think having someone objective do the observing, report early. And again, I don't think WSU did anything necessarily wrong. Again, their tempo was just way too slow because they did have that fear factor. But, you know, I don't think this. So here's what's black and white to me. It's not the observed behavior necessarily, because there's a lot of people that are on spectrums or just have inappropriate learned behavior earlier in life. I think that the how you treat women is, like you said, you know, that's kind of a pattern which you're not going to get over anytime too fast because that happens earlier.
It's pathology.
In life. It really is.
Yeah.
But to this entire thing is, again, I think the easier measure to do on this is to measure if you can just say, get out, we're done with you, or we can work with you, is that humility factor. You know, there is actually testing you can do to actually test. You can give this guy, you know, an EQ test to see where he functions on the level of EQ. Mm-hmm. If someone's got a bottomed out emotional intelligence and you baseline them coming in, whether you want to do it objectively through assessment or you want to do it subjectively just through observation, there's a way you can actually measure people's EQ, especially their emotional intelligence, their problem solving ability, their emotional regulation, their knowledge of self and knowledge of others. And if they're bottoming out on all those things and you're going to be in front of students, that's concerning. And grant, ethically, you can't use these things. You can use things. Again, you got to go through the legal thing, because I'm going pragmatically about dealing with both ideal worlds as well as how systems organize and work. But you can then baseline, hey, here's where he was coming in. Here's where we are today when the first offense is, or the second or third offense. Are we still bottom lined, or are we getting better? Because if you don't have a measure of someone getting better, that's when you boot them. Because why aren't they getting better? Why do people not get better at something in life? The only time people don't get better at something is when you lack humility. When you don't have the ability to say, okay, I'm working on this, here's what I need to do about it, you're going to stay flat. So in other words, if I observe you doing something once, twice, or three times a certain way, and you don't have humility, the likelihood of you doing exactly the same way for the rest of your life until you get that humility is almost 100. That's just science.
Do you think they could have basically stopped Koberger from coming in to begin with had they done some more tests, had they done some more personality tests to determine whether he would be a good fit for being a teaching assistant, rather than just, well, you've gotten this far along in your career, this is the next step towards your degree and where you're going, so naturally you're going to fit in here? Should we have more of that? Should we be testing people more in different ways for the areas to which we expect them to excel at, or to participate in, or lead? Because I'm going to guess there probably wasn't any, I don't know, or much in terms of identifying what kind of a human being you're getting here into this position, other than just here's his academic accomplishments.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't. I mean, I'm a, as I keep preaching on this show all the time, I'm a big believer in EQ, emotional intelligence factor, just because, I mean, and why? Well, because every time I'm dealing with someone that is really off in life, really unhealthy, what makes someone unhealthy? Their emotional intelligence is really friggin' low.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to that. Now, can you use these things legally as an ethical standard for hiring or firing or any type of position? No, but it should definitely be an input into your decision-making process. And if you're going to be in front of people, if you're going to be dealing with the public, if you're going to especially be trying to impart knowledge on students, large numbers of students, you've got to at least be at a certain level of emotional intelligence. Especially if you're going to be in teaching, you have to have a level of humility. Because if think about this, if you are actually supposed to be a PhD student, aren't you supposed to have the ability to learn? But if your emotional intelligence, your humility, your knowledge of self is so low that you actually think you're smarter than everyone else, as everyone kept saying he was, how really effective can you be? I mean, so I just, nah.
Well, wasn't able to self-reflect, it didn't seem.
Zero. Well, see,
at all.
Incapable. He wasn't wired for it. His brain was not wired for it. I mean, so think about it. Does a wolf self-reflect?
Well, and I got to ask, and I wonder this too, and this is part of the HR process that they were going through that eventually did get him fired, but they're looking at it from a liability perspective.
Right.
They're not looking at it as threat assessment perspective.
Right.
I mean, at least that's my take on it. And that's how most HR is. It's based on liability. What kind of liability does this person present to your organization? And, you know, what are we weighing here versus getting rid of him versus keeping him versus all of that? And eventually the tables turn to where they had to get rid of him. But is that approach in itself just not that effective? Is that something that needs to be kind of retooled a little bit, and not think that because we're operating from a liability perspective that anyone is actually having any sort of meaningful intervention with a character like this? When you're writing someone up, when you're slapping their wrist, you need to do better at this, Brian. I mean, it's the equivalent of almost saying to a blind person, you need to start seeing better. Well, if they can't see to begin with, all the encouragement in the world and all the scolding and writing up isn't going to change that. It's more so we need to accept people more so for who they are and what they are. And if that person is just a shitty human being or is damaged in some way, shape, or form that presents a threat to others, we need to call that out. We can't pretend that it's not there for fear of upsetting someone or them or their rights or this or that. He clearly I think had any sort of microscope looked at him other than just his educational accomplishments, others would have seen this.
So the and I've seen this. I mean, this goes across every organization. You know, me and the FBI, yeah. I faced people. I mean, government employees, you think getting rid of Koberg is hard? Try to get rid of a government employee.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I was surrounded, but I actually saw it.
Yeah.
There was like one glaring instance in my career that I worked for a guy that was doing some decent harm, in a sense that he was misogynistic, didn't think he was, and he was saying some really inappropriate things and hurting careers. And my boss's boss caught wind of it. And I've never, ever seen anyone fired, misplaced, or anything like that. She caught wind of this thing, and she canceled a major trip, a major talk, and she showed up, took a climate survey, interviewed everyone, and the next day, the guy was moved.
Good.
I was like, holy F.
That's how it's done, though.
It really is. And so, you know, so now speaking to this situation, and so how did she do that? And so this is what, and we haven't done this quite here yet either, because everyone keeps talking about Koberger. He's creepy. He's this. You're not going to get anywhere with backing when you keep poking at him. What a leader does in these situations is, all right, here's this guy's behavior, you know, right, wrong, indifference. He'll claim he can be fixed. Lawyers can claim the same. But here's where it impacts. This is what leaders do. Leaders keep a very clear understanding of what the mission is. The mission is creating a safe environment to educate the students. And so you take that and you then interview everyone in those classes that are being negatively affected by that behavior. Now the leader can then say, listen, we have an unhealthy, unsustainable, unsafe environment for learning because of this guy. Because this, now we have, instead of just poking at the one data point of creepy guy, you now have hundreds of data points saying that this is negatively affecting our mission statement. And it's much easier for lawyers, for everyone. And also, lawyers, you know, these things are mitigated a lot of times when it's reasonable. So a reasonable person in this situation, if you're going after someone with autism, which is having a hard time communicating, and that's what your focus is, a reasonable person is like, huh, you got to give him another chance. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. Everyone was so focused so much on him that they didn't look at the impact it was having on everyone else.
Exactly. It's like a spider web.
They weren't looking at the victims. So if they actually focused on the victims, and not just the four girls, but before them, the victims of all the people that were subjected to Koberger, got data points on those, papered the files with that, now you can say, hey, we need to remove him. And you're completely justified, because now you have stacks and stacks and stacks of reams of all these people talking about how what he's doing, the effect he's having, which is completely incongruent with the mission statement of the department, of the university, and of learning.
There it is. So we need better leaders. We need people who are self-reflective and saying, you know what? Your behavior is impacting all of these people. Either you shape up or we're done. Case closed. We do it in our personal lives. Why can't that be expected in our professional lives?
Because they were given him, and this is where I've said this before too, I commend the kindness of the people that gave him a lot of grace.
Right.
But here's the problem. They gave him grace, but where was the grace for everyone's being impacted by him? So what they needed to do, this is what leaders do. Leaders shift the focus from where it shouldn't be to where it should be. Victims. Everyone was being victimized by him, but they're giving him all the leeway. No. We got to focus on all the victims before the tragic victims came about. So that's what I think the focus should be. And that's where, because I've seen people do this, but it takes the leader to know how to direct the resources, how to direct the conversation. Because this is what leaders do. Leaders solve problems. They create a safe environment and the resources for the success of others. And the way they do that is by creating that safe environment. And you do that by mitigating one cancer because you're focusing on the healthy body, because that's what the mission is.
I'm sensing a seminar here that you need to put together how to train people to be good leaders.
And I love that. The reality in a lot of it, though, it comes back then to the liability of – okay, well, if you're going to do this way, then expect that, you know, you're going to get a lot of pushback over here too. It's something that we we see early in education. I mean, I witnessed this in my own child's education, where there is a lot of defending. There's a lot of making excuses for. There's a lot of not holding accountable. Extremely disruptive students, students that seem to really have no desire to be there or do much of anything. Probably come from not the best of home life, and that's not great. But at the same point, at the expense of other students and their own learning and their own education, because they don't want to rock the boat with the one that's very disruptive or causes the problems. It's more so, well, let's find a way to just kind of keep this at bay over here. And then the second one of the kids who is actively trying to learn speaks up or says something, those are the ones that get called out. You can't do that. You gotta temper that back. It's like, how about we get this in control over here and not go after the group over here? And when you start doing that very young ages, you start teaching kids, well, this is how this structure works. And it doesn't really ever solve anything. And then you have a structure of the people who are making the decisions, making poor decisions, just like the small children will be making poor decisions and stepping in or not stepping in at the right points in time. So we have a really weird dynamic of where we prioritize where we're going to put effort and where we're not going to put effort, and who is worth that time and that effort versus who is not worth that time and that effort. And it seems very off in terms of the people who are begging for the attention and begging for the instruction and begging for all of that versus the ones who are not. And we seem to really, in our education system in the U.S. publicly, we put a lot on trying to get the kids who really don't give a shit to give a shit at the expense of ignoring the ones who do give a shit. And eventually they just kind of walk away going, well, they didn't really give a shit about me.
I think the pendulum swung too far in the opposite direction.
Yes.
We need to be right in the middle. And we've been on both ends of the spectrum here. We need to come back to center, and we need to care for somebody like a Brian Kohberger in the beginning, but we also need to care about the people he's affecting. And yeah, you guys are 100% right. Yeah.
It feels that we've stopped caring about the people that are being affected. Correct. By the disruptors.
Yeah.
It's just collateral damage. And the institutions are more concerned about being sued by the disruptors or the legal consequences of how they're going to handle the disruptor versus the damage that the disruptor is creating over here.
And so here's, I know we keep thinking about the suing aspect and a legal aspect, and that's definitely a factor. But when you actually then, so say, again, here's our hypothetical thought experiment. So when you have actually a healthy environment like a university or a school system that actually is trying to mitigate a Brian Kohberger, not as a killer, but as, you know, someone who can't communicate well and he's just an ass.
Yeah.
When you're having these conversation discussions early on, one thing that you do is you include the parents, you include guardians, yes. You include people in these people's lives to see what they're doing. So because part of this process then also is understanding that letting them know, listen, here's the cause and effect of behavior. And then they're aware of it. It's in writing. And so it mitigates this legal side because also, because lawyers are always part of these conversations anyway, they will actually see, hey, everyone's being reasonable. They're the unreasonable ones. And also the likelihood of disinterested parents or parents that aren't even there, the likelihood of lawsuits for you taking action on the benefit of a greater whole is so much lower. And it's not going to go anywhere because I do this all the time when I'm working with family members or my own life or anyone. You know, and granted, we're a little jaded because we keep seeing bad court systems on a lot of these cases. Right. But in general, courts are reasonable. And what you have to demonstrate all the time is the reasonableness of the action that you're taking for the benefit of the stated benefit in writing of universities, of organizations, institutions. You then have to show the reasonable effort you went through to mitigate, to do all these things. All these things take bandwidth. They take energy. But what happens is you take that bandwidth and energy once, twice, or three times, the people then see, I don't even bother. Because look, they have a process, they have a procedure in place. And so you set that standard. And so what are we doing now? We're now leading because you're setting that standard. All it takes is one really great example, really great case to see the method, to see the routine, to see the process, to see the procedure. All the time is you're taking written rules and policies. You're having no fear to enact them and no fear of legalese either, because when you're taking reasonable action for the greater benefit of others and you're given reasonable accommodation, so it's always reasonable accommodation for someone to change their pattern of behavior and they're not taking it, that's on them. That's their behavior. So they're causing a cause and effect by their – well, I'm not making the choice. They are making the choice by their behavior being incongruent with what we said, what we counseled, what we stated in the policy.
Yeah,
it's laborious, obviously, what I'm saying, but it actually is step-by-step, very clear, very reasonable. But what's it take? It doesn't take hand-wringers, because when you start doing the hand-wringing of fear, no one's going to take action. One leader at the top, ready to fall on the sword if they have to. You know, I'm watching inside the bureau, this high executive, I'm like, wow, are they going to get sued? This is a big deal. And they're going after a power broker here. I mean, they're removing another power broker that had an allies and everything else. And I'm watching, sitting back, waiting for the fireworks. I'm waiting for the explosion. You know what happened? Nothing. You know why? It was reasonable. Mm-hmm. Because of the harm and destruction they were able to articulate, because they took the bandwidth to do all these interviews, document all these interviews of what exactly was said, on what dates, and what, blah, 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 blah. And so this person could say all they want about how they're just doing X, Y, and Z, and they're just exercising good leadership and all that. Yeah. Well, look at the death and destruction you caused in all these people and how that then trickled on down to the things they're doing. Mm-hmm. You're removed. That's reasonable.
Oh, yeah. Having the paper trail, having the documentation, having all that is so critical. I guess it's in this case, could they have done it better? Could they have done it faster? Could they have done it more efficiently? And I think is what is the question here, because he had so many months to basically have his reign of terror before they finally said, let's get rid of this guy. And I can guarantee there were people there within that first week that said, this guy's got to go now.
Yeah.
But their hands were tied, essentially, at least according to the policies that were at play at that moment in time. So if anything, hopefully at the end of the day, this is a bit more of a reality check for WSU and universities as a whole of how they handle these sort of things, how they have handled these sort of things, and how they can improve on them going forward to weed out individuals like this sooner rather than later. Because there's a lot of these people out there.
I was just going to say, are there more festering in departments and they don't know what to do and don't know how to get rid of them?
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Yep.
So hopefully this will make some sort of difference there. So I do applaud the Gonsalves for, you know, continuing to go down this road. They don't have to. I mean, they could, you know, but they're doing what they believe is right. I this is a family of like of problem solving leaders. I was going to say I don't say social justice warriors, because I don't think it's that, but just it's doing what's right.
Yeah.
In the name of their daughter that was so horribly wronged by that monster. So good for them for getting out there.
They refused to be victims by anyone.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
And that whole family is just a family of leaders. I mean, all of them, they're just going to do what's right. And it's for a greater good than by which they do it. So hats off to them. Yeah. They're doing phenomenal work for us all.
Well, and a horrible tragedy of what they went through, but look at what they are doing post. You know, they are changing the world. They are changing the world in which they live.
Yep.
Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. This book is his latest, Unbreakable Alliances. Makes a lovely stocking stuffer. But if you have a wide stocking,
it would fit in there.
or stuff it in a turkey. Surprise the family. Is this dressing? Is this Nana's famous cranberry dressing? No, it's Robin's book, Unbreakable Alliances.
That's what
we're going to read this over Thanksgiving dinner rather than argue with each other.
Wouldn't that be nice?
A
Anyway, check that out wherever books are sold. It is definitely worth checking. And the audiobook, too, also available on Audible or wherever. All right. Until next time, for Todd, for Stacey, and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.